live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome aboard another edition of Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Hope you're having a wonderful weekend wherever you happen to be. Of course, we've been living on airplanes. That should come as no surprise to you when crisscrossing the world. Let me tell you where we are. Get out your maps, boys and girls. 51 degrees, 30 minutes north. Yep, we're north. 0 degrees, 7 minutes west. We're coming to you from London in England, but it's specifically a place that I haven't been back to in a while because it hasn't been opened in a while. In fact, it was closed for quite some time while they actually redid the entire place. We'll talk about that later. The legendary Savoy Hotel. We're taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill, boys and girls. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. I first came to the Savoy Hotel when I was about 24, and they wouldn't let me in. I wasn't wearing a jacket and tie. They threw my you-know-what out of here. The second time, I figured, okay, I'll learn my lesson. It was a year later, actually. And a good friend of mine said he'd pick me up at the airport, which I thought was great because London cabs were notoriously expensive. They still are, by the way. And landed at Heathrow. It was pouring rain. I mean, it was raining beyond buckets. And for those people who may remember what kind of a car this is, my friend showed up. And my engineer, Steve, here is going to laugh when he hears this, in a Minimoke. He's already laughing. A Minimoke is basically a toy open Jeep. You couldn't get smaller or – if you ever saw the television series The Prisoner, yeah, with the Patrick McGowan, he drove a Minimoke. And in any case, this is an open Jeep. And there we were on the M4 driving into the – and I had put my jacket and tie on. I was already – we showed up looking like the biggest refugees you've ever seen in your life, and they wouldn't let me in the hotel again because I was just drenched. I actually had to go to another hotel and dry off and then come back. That was the Savoy, an amazing place. We'll talk about it later in the show, but amazing. This was built in 1889, and when they built it, it was built for people not like me. You know the old line, N-O-K-D, not our kind, dear? Well, that was it was only for the high society. In fact, the people who stayed there traveled with their own maids and butlers. And I had my maid and butler experience here in 1975. And anyway, they've just reopened it after a huge refurbishment and restoration. Not just a renovation, but a restoration. And we'll talk about that. Also, what brought me over to London was the christening of the brand new Queen Elizabeth, the third in the Cunard liners. And the third Queen Elizabeth in their history. The first Queen Elizabeth was in the 40s. The next Queen Elizabeth was, of course, the QE2, which was 1967. And the third, just christened about a few weeks ago by the Queen herself, the Queen Elizabeth. And what's interesting about it is the only person who can lay claim to have been at all three is the Queen herself. She, the first Queen was christened by Queen Mary. And she was, but Queen Elizabeth was there as a princess. The second one in 67, she was already the queen. And of course, she christened it again, the new one, in Southampton, just the other day. Interestingly enough, that all these new cruise ships are coming online now, at a time when, we don't need excess capacity. But they were all ordered, and the shipbuilding deals were done 5 years ago before the economic meltdown. So here's the interesting part of the story. When the Queen Elizabeth was put on sale, meaning when they started to sell tickets for the first cruise, it sold out in 29 minutes and 14 seconds. Everybody wanted to be first on their block to be on that ship, which, by the way, is not unusual for new ships. Everybody wants to be first. Okay, now comes the challenge. How are they going to fill the cabins the rest of the year? And how are the rest of the cruise lines? And by the way, Cunard is owned by Carnival, which has over 70 ships. How are they going to fill all those ships? And that's where discounting comes in. It's becoming an even bigger buyer's market now. With the exception of some holiday periods, you're going to see cruises, let's say 7-day cruises in the Caribbean, go for something like $523. Now, that's $60 or $70 a night, and that includes your cabin and three meals a day. You can't afford to wake up in Brooklyn for that. There are some people who thought of, like, subletting out their apartments in New York and just moving permanently to the ship. They'd make money. Now, they'd make money as long as you didn't drink, as long as you didn't go to the rock climbing wall or the casino or the spa or do a shore excursion or eat at any of the specialty restaurants. But if you just wanted to eat, I'm not kidding now, three meals a day and not spend anything on alcohol or the casino or the spa or any of those other little items, or not to mention the shore excursions, you could do it. And I actually have met people on other cruise lines who have been on there for 3 and 4 months, and they've done just that. They do their own shore excursions. It's called walking. But that's another way to immerse yourself in the culture. They drink a lot of water, and they're healthier because they're not drinking a lot of soft drinks, and they're not drinking a lot of alcohol. And there are some receptions on the ship where the alcohol is provided free when you want to meet the captain and stuff like that, and they go to that. There's a way to do it. And you don't have to have the outside cabin with a balcony. First of all, the center of gravity on a ship means that the minute there's rough water, you're whipping around the cabin if you're in one of those. If you're in an inside middle cabin, lower to the center of the ship and lower to the center of gravity, you sleep real well. And remember, you're only in the cabin to shower and sleep anyway. That's the biggest myth about cruising, that you'll be entertaining the entire state of Rhode Island in your cabin. You're not. You're going to be in that middle cabin, sleeping, showering, and maybe watching an in-room movie. That's about it. Because the rest of the time, you're out of that cabin, enjoying everything else on the ship that everybody else can enjoy. So something to think about when booking cruises. But right now, it is totally a buyer's market. And the Queen Elizabeth is one of about 12 new ships coming online in the next 10 months. You've got a new ship coming from Disney. You've got four more ships coming from Carnival. You have the sister ship to the Oasis of the Seas, that humongous ship from Royal Caribbean called the Allure of the Seas. We're talking 7,000, 8,000 people on a ship. I said it before, I said it again. A lot of cruise ship presidents think I'm being mean-spirited here. I'm not. I'm just cracking a joke. But these ships are so large, they got high crime areas on board. I'm convinced of it. Because, oh yeah, and they have jails. These ships actually have jails. Now, we're not talking 18,000 prisoner jails. We're talking about a cabin which has a serious lock and key. And why wouldn't you? Every small town in America has one. And these ships are bigger than most small towns. That's how big we've gotten. So if you want a budget for a cruise, here's what you do. You take the base price and multiply it by 1.5. And that's per person. So if the cabin's going for, you know, $600 for a week, then your real cost of the cruise is going to be closer to $900 a person. So budget for $1,800 to $2,000, and then you're not going to be disappointed at the end of the cruise when you have to go to your wallet, because you will have to go to your wallet at some point. It's still a remarkably economic opportunity to travel, considering all the things you get. And then everything else is a la carte, so just remember that. All right? When we come back, we're going to talk a lot more about the a la carte version of what's going on in the world today, especially how you book hotel rooms and what's going on with cell phone use that might surprise you. And, of course, the history of the Savoy Hotel, and there's a lot of history there. Back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide from the Savoy Hotel in London right after these messages.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Got a travel question or comment? Need advice? Jump on board now by calling the show at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you in London at the Savoy Hotel, a hotel that once threw me out but now welcomed me back. Yes, it's true. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But you know what? Based on what I was wearing at the time, I would have thrown me out. But we'll get back to that a little bit later. As promised, we're going to give you an update on the news this week and what's going on around the world with our good friend, Ben Mutzebaugh, who's from USA Today. Hey, Ben.
Good to be here, Peter. How are you?
You know, it's great. You know, I was just talking before the break on October 11th, and October 12th, actually, the Queen Elizabeth, the new ship, made its maiden voyage and bumped into your pal Gene Sloan from USA Today. He was on the ship along with me. Interesting part of history to see the Queen come out. You know what job I really want in life? The easiest job in the world. It's the slickest, easiest job in the world is speechwriter for Queen Elizabeth. Because I'd like to do my impression now of her speech at the ship. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Here it comes. I hereby name thee Queen Elizabeth. Hit the plunger, bottle breaks, she leaves. That's it. We're done.
Yeah, I would set up for the role of the queen or the king in this case. You know, I would even do you one up and take the monarch's job, Peter, to be honest.
Okay, but bottom line is she's got it made. And although one thing she did that was funny, and I know people don't usually associate the word Queen Elizabeth with a lot of yucks, but she actually toured the ship, and when she was on the bridge, they let her hit the horn.
You're kidding.
And she and everybody laughed. They thought that was really funny because the queen – then I found out later it was scripted. She was supposed to hit the horn. I thought it was a great spontaneous moment. But then again, at least she's consistent. There's nothing spontaneous about Queen Elizabeth except she I can't think of a thing that's spontaneous about Queen Elizabeth. However, she did show up and she did christen the ship. And it is quite a big ship, 90,400 tons. And really a sister ship to Queen Victoria, which brings me to one other item before we get to you, Ben, which is I was also around for the naming of the Queen Victoria, which was spontaneous and hysterically funny because it was the first time in anybody's memory they could remember that Queen Elizabeth didn't show up. She sent Camilla instead. And it was Camilla's coming out party. And she showed up with the big hat and all the pomp and circumstance. You had the London Symphony Orchestra there and the buglers and everybody was there. And Prince Charles was pacing dutifully behind her. And she came up to the podium. And by the way, her speechwriter, I think, also works with the Queen's speechwriter because her speech was, I hereby name thee Queen Victoria. And she hits the plunger with only one small problem. The bottle goes swinging and hits the ship and clunk. It doesn't break.
Well, that's never a good sign.
Well, wait. And the minute that happened, I looked at my friends and said, Diana's revenge. And then, remember, Camilla was mic'd, but Prince Charles wasn't. But he walks up behind her and he goes, the bottle didn't break. And we could all hear that. And so she goes, oh. She hits the plunger again. And this bottle goes swinging and clunk. It doesn't break again. What we didn't realize, there was a guy on a cable, strapped into a cable, suspended from the ceiling of this building by Southampton, and he walks up there with a hammer. We couldn't see it, and whacks the you-know-what out of this bottle, and then the band played and everybody went home. But the next day, all the British papers had a field day with this, and I believe it was either the Daily Mail or the Evening Standard said, Camilla's party, no big fizz. So, okay, having said that, Ben, what's going on in the world? Will you please tell me?
Well, you know, there's no shortage of things to talk about anytime we get into the world of travel. You know, one of the interesting things that you alluded to this week is, or recently, is the whole concept of airlines booking hotels through pushing their customers to book hotels through their websites and through their travel agents. So I think that's one of the interesting things we're seeing here recently in this area.
Okay, so let me ask you this, Ben. What possible benefit is it for me to book a hotel through an airline when I don't even trust the airlines?
Well, you know, that's one of the interesting questions about this. What benefit is there to the customer? It's hard to say that there really is a significant upside. Of course, you get all of your booking through one package or one reservation number. So if there's a problem with your flight or something like that, it is, in theory, easier to...
Yes, but here's the thing. Here's the interesting problem. And I'll give you a for instance, okay? If I book an air-sea package with a cruise line and my plane is delayed, the cruise line will get me to my next port because they booked the whole thing. What happens if my plane is late? Does the hotel charge me for not showing up even if I booked it on the airline's website? Aha!
Yeah, you know, that's going to be one of the interesting things. Any well-run operation will, of course,
well, stop right there. Stop right there.
You said track record in this area.
Wait a minute. You said stop right there because I said, what do you mean well-run? They're just trying to generate revenue. I'm sorry, but it's not flying, Ben.
That's right, and that's why they're doing it. Of course, is just that for every hotel, every night they can put a customer in a hotel room. However it's structured, it's going to vary, but from airline to airline. But there's some kind of kickback, as you might expect. That goes to the airline. So, and that means the bottom line is too that even if you're getting a good rate in your hotel, if you're booking it through the airline, you're probably paying $5, $10, $15 more than you would have had you booked it through the hotel itself.
All right, let's shift gears and talk about an item that's near and dear to me, of course, because I really take advantage of it now, at least on domestic flights. I love onboard Wi-Fi. I actually can fly during the day now and be very, very productive, and it really works for me. And the guys who love it more than anybody are lawyers, because it's called billable hours. They're actually making money by sitting on the plane. But it is about productivity, and I love it. But now we get into the next area, which is sort of like the brave new world of, well, we know the technology exists, but which airline is going to be either brave enough or stupid enough to allow phone use on the plane? You know, they tested it two summers ago in Portugal. They tested it in Italy. I was convinced that fights would be breaking out all through the plane because people would be annoyed at people yelling into phones. And now we've got Singapore Airlines doing Wi-Fi and maybe cell phone use.
Right. That's going to be really interesting to watch. Now, I have seen James Boyd, the spokesman for North America for Singapore, has said that they're not entirely sure to what degree, if at all, they're going to roll out the voice capacity of the service. Of course, the service, as you said, will allow Wi-Fi and in-flight connectivity, but they have kind of taken, you know, despite some of the reports that have come out, they've kind of hedged on whether they're going to allow airline calls. Of course, as you know, Emirates has allowed some cell phone calls, but that's not seemed to generate the uproar many people expected, but I think it's also kept to a pretty restricted basis on the Emirates flights. But I think it's clear no one really seems to want – we all like the Wi-Fi on planes, myself included. I think it's a real small number of us who actually want either to be able to make cell phone calls ourselves or, worse, to have our seatmates be able to do it.
Well, I have a solution for that. Let's go back to the future and build a phone booth in the plane.
I think it's worth it for anybody who feels like it's worth spending, that no one's going to be that opposed to.
And that would be the cone of silence. You put them in there. They can stay there the entire flight. I don't care. I just don't want somebody calling their nephew or their uncle saying, guess where I am? Because they, you know, when they first put the cell phone, not the cell phones, actually radio phones on the planes a couple of years ago, everybody would get on the phone and go, you'll never guess where I am. And then they got their bill and they never guessed it was that expensive.
Right. You know, at the risk of sounding like a curmudgeon here, you know, there was a day when we got in our cars, we got in our plane, you know, our flight, and, you know, we managed to survive without making a phone call. Now, I'm not saying that those days are necessarily better. I'm certainly happy to have the technology, but whether it's a two-hour flight or an eight-hour flight, I don't know if anybody really has to make a phone call in the air, but, you know, if you're going to do it, I think I like your suggestion. A phone booth is a great way to do it. It keeps everybody else safe. And, hey, if the airlines can charge, you know, $5, $10 for every 30 minutes to be in there, why not?
Listen, they've charged for everything else. The thing that's getting me angrier and angrier about airline charges is the new one from American Airlines. They want to charge up to $39 so you can sit closer to the smell of the chocolate chip cookies that you can't eat. You know, I mean, it's still a coach seat, and they've determined that being closer to the front of the cabin, even a middle seat, is being sold at a premium now. That's ridiculous.
Well, I guess they might make their connections a little tighter to help increase your incentive to sit at the front of the plane to get off earlier. You know, it is true. They're really, and it's not just American. Almost every airline has come up with some fee to give you some kind of incremental benefit, and you know, really, they're just spinning it the wrong way. They should say, hey, if you sit in the back of the plane, we'll give you $10 off. I mean, at least that's a more palatable way to, you know, to kind of push these things through. But, yeah, American is the latest to do one of the latest to do these types of things. They're, you know, in addition to that, they tap that you get on the plane earlier, you get more access to the overhead bin space. And whether that should or should not be a selling point, it certainly is nice when you are able to do that. But I think it's just the latest example. More airlines are going to do things like this.
What I want is the one airline that says, for $20 more, we'll actually get to the gate and put up a pair of portable stairs so you're not waiting at the jetway for 20 minutes because you say there's no gate available. Just give me portable stairs and get me off. I pay $20 more just to get off the plane.
Right. Well, you know, and fortunately, I think taking that a little bit farther, Alaska Airlines is doing just that. They're saying, hey, if you pay the bag fee, we're going to guarantee it arrives, your money back. At least that's someone moving in the right direction.
All right. Ben Metzenbaugh from USA Today. We will be back. I promise not to call you from the air. I really do promise that. Ben Metzenbaugh from USA. When we come back, the history of the Savoy Hotel in three easy lessons.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Avis. Avis, we try harder.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you, coming to you from the legendary Savoy Hotel in London, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill, boys and girls. Email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. You know the hotel has history when it has an archivist, an in-house archivist. In fact, she's the fourth archivist in the history of the Savoy Hotel, so you know there's history here. I'm not trying to make you feel old, Susan Scott, but I want to say welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I mean, from the moment I ever walked into this hotel when I was 24 years old, actually, I walked in and was thrown out. From the moment I walked in when I was 25 and they let me in the hotel, I mean, you're surrounded by history. You can't avoid it, and nor should you. I mean, it is just so much, so many great stories here. I could spend hours just in the American Bar alone. Which, by the way, unless I'm mistaken, when you did this incredible restoration, and the hotel was closed for how many years?
Nearly three. It's about 2 years, 10 months.
Yeah, that's a long time to close a hotel.
It is, but you've seen what we've done here.
Absolutely. But what's interesting about it is you walk in. I had lunch earlier at the foyer, at the Thames Foyer restaurant there. And what you've done with the light in that room, it used to be such a dark room. Now it's so much brighter, natural light from the dome. But the thing is, the American Bar alone, you haven't really changed much of that at all.
No, we haven't, actually. That was something I think that our regulars were a bit concerned about when we closed. They thought we were going to change it in a very big way. And actually, the decision was made to leave it exactly as it was, because it was perfect.
Let's talk about the history here, because everybody I know has stayed here. I will tell you my story. And by the way, okay. What I'm about to tell you is not unusual. You've heard the story from so many of your other guests. When the hotel was first built, and I said this at the opening of the show, the people who stayed here were a very, very high pedigree, and they had their own maids with them in many cases, their own servants, their own butlers. And the woman who was traveling, the lady, always had a maid with her whose job it was to go to the bathroom and draw the bathwater. And they designed the hotel in such a way that the maid wouldn't be in there very long because they designed a water pressure system that was ingenious. It had great water pressure plus booster pumps, so that tub filled in about 30 seconds. I mean, it came out like a fire hose, right? You turn the tub on, and 30 seconds later, the bath is waiting. Well, for those of us Americans who are not used to great water pressure, I walk in there one day, oh, look at this bath. It's a deep bath, a great bath. I turn the water on. I go to make a phone call. I flood out the entire floor. Right. How many floods did you have? I mean, I remember David Frost flooding out Marvin Hamlish. Because people forget how fast that water comes out.
We've probably had one or two unfortunate accidents over the years. The most famous ones, you're in very good company, is actually Elton John, who did it in the early 80s. So
Elton John did a lot of things in the early 80s.
Well, one of the things he did was flood out his Savoy bathroom.
Right. It happens.
It happens. Does, yes.
And in the interest of full disclosure, my house was destroyed in the earthquake in 94 in Los Angeles. When it came time to build a new house, I came back to the Savoy and I said, I want the shower head. I bought the shower head from the Savoy and it's now in my house in Los Angeles because it comes out like a fire hose. It's phenomenal.
And it's also very large, which is also...
It's a large fire hose, yes. Yeah. When you do a restoration like this, because there are two reasons why you close a hotel. One, of course, for the artistic nature of it and then preserve the aesthetics, but also because it needed work. There's no doubt about the fact that the Savoy really needed some work. And it had to be put back together again. But where is the line that you don't want to cross between renovating and taking away from it in terms of what it really was?
Well, we obviously don't want to take away from it at all. I think the idea was, yes, it did need work, and it was a big decision to make to close it, certainly, because we've never been closed before in nearly 121 years at that time. But what we wanted to do was really just restore it to what it really should be and give it a chance, and I think give the workmen a chance to really have a go at that. In a way,
and you had 1,000 workmen here.
Quite probably. I will take your word for it.
You have to. I did my research on
this. Good.
Yeah. But what was interesting about it is there are certain things, it's not that you didn't want to touch them. You couldn't touch them because they are of such historic nature.
There are some things that we absolutely wouldn't want to change at all and that we treasure because they're original features.
Like?
Well, for example, the front hall, there's a fantastic frieze in the front hall that's original, and the panelling and the light fittings, so and the layout of it, actually. So when you walk in, that's the front hall that you would have walked into in when it was new, which actually is 1904. It's the slightly newer part of the hotel, rather unusually. We're a game of two halves. We have an older half, the original part of the hotel, which you're sitting in now, which dates from 1889, and then the new part, which is the front hall and that block.
Well, what's interesting to me is when I first checked into this hotel, you actually had to go, like, walk through a maze to find your room because there were add-ons, and it wasn't all built at the same time. And it was interesting to find the room. I mean, I finally learned my way around.
It does take a little time, and you do need to learn which lifts to use, but there are plenty of staff to guide you, so I would hope you wouldn't have that trouble.
Oh, by the way, it was a staff person who took me to my room because I was totally lost.
Oh, all right.
See, it happens, but that's part of the charm. You have to find – it's called Find Your Room at the Savoy. Trust me, that's a joke.
Okay.
It's fine. It's okay. Take a moment.
No, breathe. I do know because we built the two blocks, we didn't have joins on every floor, so you had to know if you got in the lift, you had to know which lift to get in to get between the two blocks of the hotel.
When we come back, I want to talk about the lobby because from an architectural point of view, I remember the old lobby completely different than what I walked into today in terms of where the front desk was, in terms of where the concierge desk was, things that are just completely different. So let's wait about that till we come back. We are with Susan Scott, the archivist for the Savoy Hotel, and when we come back, we're going to talk about that. Plus, my favorite thing about this hotel, the bathrobes. We'll be back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after these messages.
Now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Continental Airlines. With over 260 destinations in more than 50 countries, Continental makes it easy to create your own worldwide tour. Continental Airlines. Work hard. Fly right.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, we've been talking to Susan Scott, the archivist for the Savoy Hotel, where we are broadcasting from and taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know what to do. You just email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. When you're restoring a hotel like this, what was the most surprising find you discovered in terms of history? That was a wow factor because, Susan, most hotels aren't museums. I look at the Savoy also as a museum.
I think what I found fascinating when I walked around it, when it was still a building site, was because we'd had the opportunity to pull a lot of things off the walls, for example, that had been added on. We've got so many years of things being layered over each other. And as we sort of were able to peel them back, you're able to open up all sorts of odd little alcoves or recesses or find out what's been going on underneath and see the bones of the building. And I find that fascinating because you see little scraps of old wallpaper that you know are actually bits of wallpaper that have been covered over for 100 years and that the original people who walked around the hotel would have seen. So I actually really quite enjoyed it at that rather sort of spare stage when it looked a bit frightening and was rather minimal, really. But there were all sorts of little things you could see and you could think, oh, I wonder what that little funny window that's been bricked up and turned into something else was.
And did you ever, were you able to replace the window, actually, or restore it?
It depends where they were, because obviously the great remodel was the one that happened in 1904, and so obviously because we added a front section, if you like, the Strand section of the hotel onto
right.
The old section. So, no, obviously we wouldn't turn things back.
Well, certain things haven't changed. For example, unless I'm mistaken, it's the only street in London that you actually drive on the right side of the road.
This is absolutely correct, yes. So it's very familiar, really, for people who drive on the right.
Right.
And all the taxi drivers know about it, of course.
Oh, absolutely. They love it.
They do.
They test their skill because they have to do the opposite way.
It is. It's clearly marked on the road in case you're confused. We've actually written it quite clearly now. So.
And one of the things historically about this hotel are the private dining rooms.
They are fabulous, aren't they? Have you had a chance to look in some of them?
Oh, yeah.
Good. I'm glad.
Well, what makes them so fascinating, though?
Well, they actually, the oldest ones were part of the 1889 hotel. We had the restaurant, which you know, and then next to it were private dining rooms, and they still exist today. And then gradually we turned rooms up this side of the hotel into private dining rooms. So we're sitting in one now, and this is actually the smallest and most intimate, as I'm sure you can realize,
yes,
as we're in it. But they're all different sizes, and they're no two of them are alike. They're all named after Gilbert and Sullivan operas because of the Gilbert and Sullivan connection with the hotel.
And we're in the Sorcerer's Room.
We are in Sorcerer, yes.
Yes. Now, there are two things that distinguish the hotel from me, having stayed so many times. One, actually three if you include the shower head. The second are the bathrobes, because this is so ingenious, and I've used this as an example to other hoteliers around the world as to how you're supposed to do things in the smart way. When I checked into the hotel and I was walking into the room, what I didn't realize was that the bellman was literally sizing me up. And then he would call down to housekeeping, and they would deliver him a bathrobe. So it was not like one size fits all. But here was the genius part. Let's say he thought I was an extra large, which, by the way, 68 pounds ago I was. They would send up a double XL or a triple XL, but there were no sizes on the bathrobe. So all of a sudden you put the bathrobe on, you suddenly felt so thin and so fit. A family of five could get in there with you. You loved yourself. You loved the hotel. And I ended up buying as many of these bathrobes as I could. They were the thickest Irish terry. You got the monogram. A friend of mine did it for his entire wedding party. They went crazy. They loved it. So that's the first thing. And the second thing, of course, is the Savoy was, in terms of branding, you made your own beds.
We did, actually. We had our own bed company and built our own beds, and we did that for many years, I mean decades, really. And the bed, it's the mattresses, they're,
yes,
handcrafted. And later there was a management buyout, and they became an independent company. But they still exist under a slightly different name now, and they're still making the bed for the Royal Suite is, in fact, a bed that's been made by them.
Not bad.
Which is fantastic.
Now, for people who've never been to the hotel before who want to take a tour, can you take a tour, a historical tour of the hotel?
We don't normally run them on a regular basis.
But for everybody listening to the show who calls up and says, can I go, you'll do that, won't you, Susan?
Well, of course, if people want to do something like that and they do want to contact the hotel, we'll see what we can do. We would really try very hard to be able to show the hotel if we could, because we're very proud of it.
How much money was spent on this restoration?
I understand £220 million.
But who's counting?
Exactly, and worth every penny.
Of course. And I take credit for it now. There's a company in California that now sells the Savoy showerhead based on me. And I get nothing for it. Absolutely nothing.
Well, thank you very much then. We're very grateful.
Well, thank you. Susan Scott, the archivist for the Savoy Hotel. And welcome 24 hours a day for your calls to give tours. I know you hated that, don't you? It's okay, Susan. It's okay. Take a deep breath. It's okay. We'll be back with more of your questions and emails from the Savoy Hotel right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
52 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here from the Savoy Hotel in London, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You just email me to peter@petergreenberg.com. And also a recommendation that you go to our website, which has the imaginative name petergreenberg.com, to get the comprehensive list of aid and relief organizations doing all that essential hard work in Haiti, in Western China, in Chile, and, of course, in the Gulf. It may not be on the front pages where you live, but it's on our front pages, and they need all the help they can get. I've often said that if you want to really rate a hotel, don't go by what you think. Ask a woman, because I'm convinced that most hotel designers are not women. In fact, they wouldn't know. I am convinced that most hotel designers should be forced to spend at least two nights in their hotel that they design before they're ever paid for their job. And joining me now is somebody who spends almost as much time in hotels as I do, from Travel and Leisure, Michaela Guzzi. Hey, Michaela.
Hi, how are you, Peter?
Listen, I always said, you know, you judge the hotel first by the bathroom, the way a woman would judge the bathroom, starting with the light.
Absolutely. absolutely. I mean, now, for starters, how am I supposed to look fantastic at business meetings if I can't see where I'm putting my eyeliner?
I have that problem all the time. No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, some favorite hotels that I've recently experienced was actually in where you are right now in London, at the Stafford. I actually tweeted about how excellent the lighting and the mirrors were, and someone wrote back to me in 30 seconds asking to book a block of rooms. So it's clearly very important to us ladies out there.
Absolutely. You know, you're speaking now for the Maybelline Corporation. No, I'm kidding. Just kidding. All right, but we start with light, but then there's one more thing that goes along with that in a hotel bathroom, and that's specifically, I'm sorry to say, more appropriate to women than men. There's usually not enough counter space for all the garbage you take with you.
It's very true. I like to think that I spend a lot of time packing and being very strategic. But that said, we have lots of gadgets and gizmos that are absolutely necessary to us. And one hotel, actually, that has done it extremely well is the Andaz on Fifth Avenue in New York City.
They just opened that hotel. They did a great job, yeah.
Great lighting. It's not all cramped up in there, and there's places to actually put your things on the counter.
Now, I know you're a gym rat. I know that a lot of people, you know, they don't change their lifestyle when they change their location. They hit the hotel looking for the health club. But health clubs and hotels, and many of them, I mean, not all of them, but in many of them, they're like afterthoughts. They're like stuck in basements.
Yeah, they're mostly depressing, but two hotels recently that have done it extremely well are the St. Regis in Mexico City and the Address Hotel in Dubai. I have to say, these two hotels, not only do they have extensive equipment, they have people there in the gym to answer questions, show you how to use the machinery. They might even have private yoga classes or someone on call. But the views of their respective cities of Mexico City and of Dubai are actually breathtaking. They're some of the most beautiful places within the hotel itself.
Okay, now I got one for you. I'm going to trump you on this one. This is a good one.
Okay.
Hotel dry cleaning. I hate it. First of all, it's excessively expensive, and they have this rule that it has to come in by 9 or it doesn't get back by 5. A bellman once said to me, you know what, tip me $5, I'll take it to the dry cleaner around the corner, I'll bring it back to you in 2 hours, and it was half the price that the hotel was charging me.
That is absolutely brilliant.
There's even one more brilliant one than that, which I can't take credit for. The late Merv Griffin said to me, and by the way, Merv was not hurting for money. He was at a hotel in Paris and saw what they were going to charge him to dry clean his shirt. He looked across the street and saw a thrift shop. Okay? No, he's not going to do what you think he did. He actually took the shirt and donated it to the thrift shop. What's the first thing the thrift shop did? They dry cleaned it, and the next day he went and bought it back for $5.
That's hilarious. That's actually one of the better stories I've ever heard before. Yeah, I mean, I have to say I agree with you. Hotel dry cleaning is absolutely outrageous. And, yes, of course, when you're traveling on business, it's, you know, expensible to the company. But I can't have American Express, my parent company, raising their eyebrows that I just spent, you know, $70 having two items dry cleaned.
Although, darling, if they raise their eyebrows, they did it with proper lighting.
True. And they can be plucked properly now. But actually, there are a few hotels out there that maybe it's not dry cleaning, but laundry, which goes a long way. There's a hotel called The Cliffs down in Chile, and I have to say, free laundry the entire time you're there. Free laundry, free dry cleaning.
I'm showing up with laundry. I'm going to just show up with laundry.
Too often. What was
that? I'm going to just show up with laundry. Where's the hotel? Where in Chile is the hotel?
It's in northern Patagonia, so I don't know how much business you'll have down there, but you should absolutely go on vacation there. It's one of the best places on earth.
You know what they should do when they, you know, with all the rescued miners, they should basically do a deal saying, come on, stay with us, we'll clean up everything.
That's actually not a bad idea, Peter.
You like that marketing idea. See, we think alike. All right, I love this. All right, so if you want more about this information, of course, it'll be all on our website, and we want to thank our good pal, Michaela Guzzi from Travel and Leisure, who has to go back to the bathroom now and work on those eyebrows.
Thank you.
You got it. And when we come back, a whole lot more from the Savoy in London. Lots of your emails are going to get through today because they've been holding up like planes over LaGuardia. Lots of that, plus updates on the cruise industry. How much of a buyer's market is it? Might be surprised. And are hotels getting suddenly more expensive? Are they being able to fill their rooms? The answer is not what you think. And sometimes it could be bad news unless you listen to the show. We'll be back with more from the Savoy right after this.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com. Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome aboard Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Hope you're having a wonderful weekend wherever you happen to be. We are actually, get your maps out, 51 degrees 30 minutes north, 0 degrees 7 minutes west. We're coming to you from the Savoy Hotel in London, England, a hotel that was built in 1889, opened in 1904, and just recently reopened after a massive three-year restoration project. Well worth the visit, even if you're not staying here, if you want to see some great history in action. Taking your calls, of course, at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. Let's go right to some of those emails. One from Gabby in Red Lodge, Montana. I would like to know what is the best time to get travel insurance. My sister and I are cruising Hawaii in March, and she is recovering from cancer. Do we buy trip insurance now or later? Does it get more expensive to buy if you wait until just before you cruise? Well, remember, I've talked about this on the show before. There are really essentially three types of travel insurance. There's trip cancellation and interruption service insurance. There is, of course, your medical insurance, because a lot of your medical insurance doesn't cover you outside the United States, although Hawaii would be covered. And then, of course, there's medical evacuation and repatriation insurance, which I would carry no matter what. But what you're talking about, I'm assuming, is trip cancellation and interruption insurance. And that is, of course, if the cruise doesn't operate or you can't go for whatever reason. The best thing to do on that is there's no incentive to buying it later. The premium doesn't go up as you get closer to the date. Just buy it now. And then if you don't go, you get the you're covered. But remember, each policy is different, Gabby. There is insurance that will cover you if the operator doesn't travel, or if there's a financial problem, or there's a political act of terrorism or a natural disaster. But then there's the insurance that covers you for any reason whatsoever, because let's say you wake up one morning and you decide you just don't want to go or you can't go. Depending on where you think you're going to be, you basically buy that calculated risk of that particular type of insurance. Obviously, the premiums do differ by policy. A policy that lets you cancel for any reason whatsoever is a premium of about 16% of the cost of the trip, whereas the other premiums are about between 9 and 12%. So I hope that's helpful. From Nicole in Hopkinton, Massachusetts, we recently booked travel to Europe on TAP Air Portugal via their website and chose that airline both for the airfare and because they're a partner of United, where we have a lot of miles. Unfortunately, part of our flight was operated by SATA, S-A-T-A Airlines, which we didn't know until we arrived at the airport, was in very, very tiny type on the reservation saying, you're not going to get your mileage. She just wanted us to warn that that TAP told us that the mileage should count. United then refused to count the miles. For four people taking a trip to Europe, that's a lot of miles. Well, here's another one for you. What's the point of a loyalty program that doesn't reward you for your loyalty to begin with? I just tried to redeem some miles myself on United, and they said no flights available. I said, well, you know, normally you extort me by saying you don't have the seats at 30,000 miles, but you have them at 60. Okay, I'll go for 60. No seats available. Okay. How about in business class? No seats available. How about in first class? No seats available. When in my lifetime will there be seats available? They're not available. Well, you know what? In any court, in any state in the United States, that constitutes bait and switch. That is detrimental reliance. It's a breach of contract. And yet the airlines get away with it every day because under deregulation, under federal deregulation, not a single airline is allowed to be governed by the laws of any U.S. state. So that's a problem. And I am angry about this. A lot of you are angry about this, and as we see more and more consolidation and mergers in the airline business, we're about to get only angrier. I would like, okay, this is a less than subtle hint to any attorneys listening to this show. I would love for you guys to file a class action suit, which I will be gladly a part of, suing the airlines for their frequent flyer programs, claiming, and I think there's a lot of judges that would listen to this case, that the airlines are in violation of operating what constitutes an illegal and unregulated lottery when it comes to frequent flyer programs. That's what it's become. You know, the inducement for you to join the program is that at 25,000 miles, you're going to have a pina colada around your neck and you're going to be having a great time on a beach. And when you get to that 25,000 miles, that's often not the case. That is bait and switch. You joined it to your own detriment because you can't use the miles. Now, the airlines will always argue that they're more robust than ever. I disagree. I disagree based on my own personal experience. And nobody flies – I won't say that. Most people don't fly more than I do. And it's as simple as that. I mean, if I'm going to earn the miles, let me use the miles. Oh, and by the way, for all the flights that United Airlines told me there are no seats available, I then went not only online, but I actually called a human being and found out I could have gone bowling on those flights. There were so many empty seats. They are just not willing to part with a single seat if they think it's going to displace revenue passengers. We've become a nation of addicted mileage junkies. You know, everybody's a member of at least one, if not two programs. I'm a member of all of them, and many of you are members of more than you even care to admit. But the bottom line is, if I'm going to work that hard to earn the miles, why should I die trying to redeem them? Well, the answer about that is even better. You don't have to die trying. What you do is, people don't realize this, it's legally possible for you to deed or will those miles to somebody else. Put it in your will. Let them die trying. You're already going to be dead. Let them die trying. And at least you leave this planet knowing that somebody else is going to have the same problem you did. It's sort of like the gift that keeps on not giving. Am I being subtle about this at all? I don't think so. And I sent an email to the guys at United saying, what is the point of me having millions of miles on your airline if I'm never able to redeem them, even if I'm willing to pay the premium miles? This is a joke. Except the joke's on me, and I'm not happy about that. And you shouldn't be happy about it either. Email me. Let me know your thoughts. And by the way, we're going to be doing a segment on this upcoming on the early show about the myth, the marketing myth of frequent flyer programs. They make more money for the airlines than the airlines make operating as airlines. Do you know that the market valuation of the American Airlines frequent flyer program is about $6.4 billion? Because the airlines make so much money selling miles to partner companies like banks and florists and grocery stores, knowing full well they also control the redemption. They're printing the currency and they're stopping you from spending the currency. Loan sharks and the mafia are worshiping at the altar of the airlines. They couldn't get that kind of return. They couldn't. This is wrong. And I'm pretty sure there's not a single judge in this country that would refuse to hear this case. You know why? Because they were denied the redemption of their own miles. There's not a judge that could disqualify himself or herself because they're all members. And they're all as angry as I am. So I say, lawyers of America, unite for me on this one. Somebody file a class action lawsuit claiming the airlines are operating an illegal and unregulated lottery with their frequent flyer miles. I will join that suit in a heartbeat. If anybody wants to disagree with me, it'll cost you 50 miles. We'll be back with more from the Savoy Hotel in London. Peter Greenberg Worldwide back with more, or actually less frequent flyer miles, right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Got a travel question or comment? Need advice? Jump on board now by calling the show at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, taking your calls right here at the Savoy Hotel in London at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. If you've been listening to the show, you know I was ranting and raving about my favorite subject, the inherent fraud of frequent flyer programs, where you cannot redeem the miles you've earned. And yet we all like to boast about how many we have. Isn't that pathetic? One of my suggestions before the break was to get all the lawyers to unite and file a class action lawsuit against the airlines claiming they're running an illegal and unregulated lottery when it comes to frequent flyer programs. What does our next guest think about that? Well, we're going to ask her. Lee Gallagher, the assistant managing editor at Fortune Magazine. Hello, Lee.
Hi, Peter. Great to be with you.
Well, what do you think? You think I got a shot at this?
I think you definitely have a shot at this. I mean, look, I'm a big, big fan of consumer rights, as you are too, and these companies exist to kind of extract, give us the least while extracting the most. I mean, it's kind of like the banks on Wall Street, if you think about it. So,
sure.
There needs to be some sort of control to rein them in. That's ridiculous that you can't redeem frequent flyer miles. It just makes no sense.
Well, I go back to 1984, when Pan Am, some idiot at Pan Am, looked at all the unredeemed miles they had in there that people were carrying around, and they came up with this great idea. I say that sarcastically, of course. And they sent out an email message. It wasn't even an email. They sent out it was actually a mailed message. You got it in the mail, saying to all their frequent flyer members, oh, by the way, all those miles you've earned, if you don't use it by the end of this year, it was actually 1988. If you don't use it by the end of this year, you'll lose it. People had no intention of using their miles. All of a sudden, flooded Pan Am. Every plane was full, and Pan Am basically almost went out of business in 1988. Ultimately, went out of business in 91, but in 1980, because everybody was flying on mileage. I'm not suggesting that. I'm not suggesting a run on the banks. You couldn't run on this bank. The bank's not open, is what I'm saying. So,
right.
What I'm suggesting is, if I've earned the miles and there's a seat on the plane, why not give it to me? We just saw that happen with Starwood. They got smart in their lodging program for their frequent stay program, and they basically said, why should we penalize the guys who earn the most amount of points by telling them that entire months of November and December are blacked out in Arizona or you can't get to Hawaii? So they made a deal with their owners. It's a different business model, but the philosophy is the same. They made a deal with all the owners of their hotels where they had franchises and said, look, anytime you're more than 92% occupied, we're going to buy rooms from you at a prearranged rate so that we can satisfy our frequent stayers so they can redeem their points. Why shouldn't the airlines do something similar?
It's absolutely true. You're right. I mean, these are your absolute best customers. These are the people you want to really bend over backwards for, because they are the people that are going to keep coming back again and again. And, if you do things like this and make them disloyal, then you've just said goodbye.
I go back to the original days of Virgin, and I remember when Richard Branson came out with his own frequent flyer program. It's not done that way now, but I love the concept. When you got on the plane, they gave you a voucher good for a free one-way coach ticket because you'd flown in business class.
That's great.
And yes, but it was one way based on space available. But if there was space available, you got on. They didn't withhold the space. If there was a seat on the plane, you got it. What's wrong with that?
Nothing, because, that's a smart business decision. If the capacity's there, they are engendering good positive feelings with their customers and using a very effective tactic to retain them, which is what really what this business is all about. It's so hyper-competitive that you have to hold onto your customers. You have to fight tooth and nail for every last one of them. So it's almost like if you're going to put these rules in and not really redeem the miles, you might as well get rid of the program altogether. Then people would be angry, but they couldn't claim that it was a bait and switch.
Exactly. On the flights that I wanted to go on, they told me there were no frequent flyer seats available. There were at least 40 empty seats on every one of those flights. Now that's just wrong.
Yeah, it's wrong.
Well, what are we going to do about it, Lee? I want you to just rise up and get angry. Come on.
Peter, that's what you're here for.
Oh, okay, it's me. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, let's talk about just an overall thing here. Let's get our crystal ball together here and talk about 2011. Are there any bright spots?
Well, I would say the biggest bright spot, talking in terms of the travel market, is that, we are starting to see, as you know, business travel is rebounding and leisure travel is rebounding. Marriott just came out a couple days ago with its third quarter results that were up from a loss about a year ago, and it's boosted both room rates and occupancy levels. So things are starting to turn around. But I will say what's happening in the travel industry is very much a reflection of the broader economy, which is things are coming back. We are in a recovery, even if some days it doesn't feel like it. We absolutely are. However, this is not going to be a big V that everyone's talking about. This is going to be a long, tough slog, and that applies to travel as well.
So it's not a V, it's a W.
It's not a V, it's a W. It could be a W. A W implies a double dip. It could be, some people are calling it, It's a slightly upturned L. So you could
hey, listen,
you
as long as it's not,
it's not going to be easy.
As long as it's not an F.
That's true.
For all those reasons. But do you see any good signs in terms of strategic visionary thinking in terms of high-speed rail? I mean, everybody talks about it, but I'm not seeing it yet.
No, I mean, that you're absolutely right. I think we need to see it first. I think so much depends on companies spending, and companies have a lot of cash. They're sitting on unprecedented amounts of cash, and one of the things that's holding everybody back is confidence. So I think the more we go on, the more it becomes clear that things are that we're working out of this, companies will start hiring back people, investing in their own infrastructure, and all this stuff is basically like grease that keeps the economy moving. So there is, you know, that's definitely something on the horizon.
Now, there's a dirty six-letter word. I hear it all the time in hushed tones. Are you ready? I'm going to do it the way I hear it. Here it is.
Okay.
Luxury.
Well, luxury is one of those words. What does it really mean anyway? I mean, it's kind of been adapted by the industry to mean many, many, many different things, as you know. And, you know, we're hearing that even at some of the big luxury brands, things are doing well. I mean, they, too, are seeing a rebound. But I think what's happening there is that, you know, the high-end consumer is not going to stop taking vacations. What they might do is stay a little closer to home, or they might take a 5-day trip instead of a 10-day trip, or a 7-day trip instead of a 14 trip. And we're still seeing those patterns. So that does translate into a paring back that affects the high end of the market. But at the same time, these customers are still there. We saw just a couple months ago some positive numbers coming out of some of the retailers like Saks and Neiman Marcus, and that's all part of the same block of consumers, really. So they're starting to open up again. So, and, you know, you're seeing a little bit of development. You're seeing more places open. You're seeing you know, there's things to get them excited to travel again as well.
All right, now, you know, everybody talks about the bucket list. I in this economy, I talk about it as something else. I call it the panic list.
Yeah.
Because people are saying, if we don't go now, we're never going to go. If we don't go now, we're never going to go. So they're taking that list and they're sort of like accelerating it. I remember people in Paris last summer who, you know, were crowded into French hotels, knowing full well how expensive it was. And when I asked them, wait a minute, you knew how expensive it was before you came over here? Yeah. But you're still here? Yeah. Why? We felt if we didn't go now, we'll never go. Are you seeing that too?
Well, it's true. I mean, this whole economic experience kind of puts things in perspective. It makes people really appreciate and value spending time with their family and taking time off, especially if you think about all the people that are making career switches right now. Obviously, they don't necessarily have the money, but they have the time, which is a precious, precious commodity.
Sure.
So I do think that there is some truth to that. I love that expression, the panic list. I mean,
it is.
The thing about that is the one thing that can throw those plans off track is the slightest hint of geopolitical turmoil, as you know, just makes people cling to our shores. So that can happen at any given moment. You know, we've been pretty safe for a while, but you just that's one thing that can derail those plans.
I got it. Let's market a whole new campaign called Shore Clinging Vacations.
Hey, if the water's warm.
That's right. Where are you? We're clinging. We're over here clinging. We're going to cling this year. We're going to cling as a family. No? Okay. What about the hot new destinations?
Hot new destinations. Well, we've looked lately at we have a new story in our new issue about what's happening on the ski slopes, because this is the time of year we start to think about that. And the ski business, again, reflecting the economy. Last year was pretty bad, but they're starting to see it start to come back at the end of the season. And what they saw, what resorts saw, was early pre-bookings. So places started to fill up, for example, for the Christmas holiday this year and New Year's. You know, they saw early bookings in a way that they hadn't seen the past couple of years. So things are likely to be more crowded. There are new resorts opening here and there. There's a lot happening in Deer Valley and Park City, which is a great place to go, and it's remarkably convenient for almost everybody in the country. You get a lot of direct flights there, unlike you know, the Aspen area or Vail. It's an easier trip. But across the ski slopes, we're seeing a lot of technology is being applied, so there's all sorts of new tools and apps and gadgets that you can use when you're skiing that will do everything from count how many times you went down the big brag-worthy black diamond slope.
Well, you know what the deal is? Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, we can come up with a whole new campaign called Cling and Ski. You can cling and ski. Lee Gallagher, the assistant managing editor of Fortune Magazine, one of our regulars on the show. Thank you, Lee. When we come back, one of our guests who I normally always call from long distance, but he's actually here in London, and he'll explain why when we come back to the Savoy Hotel.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Avis. Avis, we try harder.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from the Savoy Hotel in London and taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. My next guest, we're always calling him somewhere else in the world where we're not, and he is. Today we're actually both in the same city at the same time in the same place. He's the contributing editor for Budget Travel, named Sean O'Neill. Hey, Sean.
Hi, Peter. It's an honor to be here and actually meet you in person.
I know, because we've been phone buddies for a long time. What brings you to London? Come on, you can admit it now.
I'm an expat now. I've moved here, and I'm writing from here for the States. So it's great.
And why London?
I have a modest command of the language here, and I have dual citizenship with, so it makes it easier for me to actually reside here.
Wow. With dual citizenship because you're Irish.
With Irish and Ireland and UK right, so, have an agreement.
Right, so you really came here to drink.
That's right, at the local pub.
Which you can only find one every 3 feet. Well, since you're now the expert expat, I mean, what have you discovered that's not in the brochure here in London? First of all, we're coming from the Savoy, which has got so much history.
Absolutely.
And it's a living, breathing museum. So, I mean, when you think about who stayed here, you know, we were earlier, you know, of course, all the movie stars and the Elton Johns and the, but no, it's also Claude Monet.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean, and he painted from here.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, I mean, there's just so much stuff. But what have you found?
Well, it's so important for your listeners the next time they visit London not to just bring the guidebook. I mean, you need to pick up one of the listings guides like Time Out or pick up, go to a website like
And by the way, I'm not a shill for Time Out, but I find it fascinating. They can put that thing out every week.
Yeah.
And it's just so full of stuff.
Absolutely. And so there'll be exhibits and galleries and pop-up theater events that you won't be able, they won't be able in the time length of the expiration date to publish in the guidebook. For example, in Kensington Gardens right now, Anish Kapoor, the guy who did the Millennium Beam in Chicago's Grant Park, he has an exhibit that's on several glass figures. One's a giant glass disc that looks like a satellite dish large enough to contact Saturn. And it's sitting there in this Royal Gardens with all this beautiful, and you can just sort of get there and meditate.
And you've been contacting Saturn, so tell me how that's been going on.
Yeah, beware if you hear any strange, like, solid chord, like out of 2001, then you should be worried.
Your driver's name is Zargon.
That's right.
What else?
Well, you also should check out a lot of the local pubs. There's a new book and website.
Yeah, I knew we're back to pubs
right,
again.
Right, yeah. Pubs, but also breakfast. One of the best ways to understand a local culture that hasn't been sort of globalized yet in countries that you visit is to eat the local breakfast. And there's a London Review of Breakfast's website and book that lists all the best breakfasts in London. People go out and they review them. And so that can be a neat tip to start your day.
So basically, that's your latest scam. You claim you're a breakfast reviewer. No?
Got to make a living.
It's working
right?
For somebody. What I find great about London is, let's face it, you know, with due respect to our engineer Steve, who is British, London food traditionally sucks. And I came back here through like Julie's Pantry and Wimpy and all those crazy bad places, you know, where the definition of sautéed was actually deep fried, and that was about what it was. Well, London's now coming to its own in terms of cuisine. I mean, it's cutting edge. There's no doubt about it. And it's not just Gordon Ramsay. It's a lot of other great chefs. But also, the ethnic food here in London is, I mean, the best Indian food, the best Thai food. Mm-hmm. There's a Greek place that I live at here called Halepi, which is right off the Bayswater Road.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this little hole. It's been there for 40 years. And it's just family run. And you walk in there and there's, you're bumping a Richard Branson meeting. I mean, because people just love that food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you find in London, great ethnic food.
Absolutely. It's such an international city. And the food from, if you may not like the local British food, although it's improved tremendously over the years, you will definitely find great cuisine.
And, of course, you always have the plowman's lunch at any pub.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Fish and chips, which had its 150th anniversary this year.
And how do they celebrate that? By more drinking?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure. What about the museums?
There's some fantastic museums. The V&A has the Raphael cartoons, which are the sort of like the line sketches that Raphael used for creating a lot of his artworks on display. And also the V&A is just a great museum to visit because it has probably the world's best cafeterias. It looks like you're going to St. Paul's Cathedral.
Are you talking about the Blueprint Cafe?
Yes.
Yeah. My cousin had his reception there after he got married there. It was great.
Wow, that's amazing.
Phenomenal.
Lucky man.
Now, I know it's going to sound cheesy to some, but if you've never done it, you got to do it once. Go see the Changing of the Guard. People are going to laugh at me, but I'm telling you, you got to do it once.
No, it's an incredible tradition. And also on Saturdays, they give free tours of the Houses of Commons and Parliament, so you get to see how the laws are made and where the Queen comes in and opens up the state. It's a neat experience.
And, of course, if the flag is flying above Buckingham, that means she's home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she may not be accepting phone calls, but she's home.
She gave her recent YouTube video. She's very up to date. Yeah. She doesn't just do phones.
I know, but I still want to be the Queen's speechwriter. The best job known to man. When she actually christened the Queen Elizabeth, the new ship in the Cunard line.
Just a few days ago.
You know what she did? Yeah. She sat there and she basically said, I hereby name thee Queen Elizabeth. Push the button, the bottle broke, and she left. That was it.
I was told they didn't want to let her handle the bottle because they were afraid she might injure herself.
No, they didn't want to handle the bottle because they were afraid it wouldn't break.
Oh, the poor dear.
That's what happened with Camilla. You know, she did it, and the bottle didn't break.
Oh, I didn't know that.
For the Queen Victoria, yes, otherwise known as Diana's Revenge. I'm serious. It was a little embarrassing. It was the first time that they had christened one of the Cunard ships that it wasn't the Queen herself. They sent Camilla, and the bottle didn't break. You're liking that one, aren't you, Sean?
I am.
Anytime there's a breaking bottle joke, Sean O'Neill, the Irish guy, is laughing. All right, Sean O'Neill, contributing editor for Budget Travel, welcome back home.
Thank you, Peter.
We really appreciate it. When we come back, more of your emails, and we got lots of them. And then talk about a living museum. We've got one you've never heard about when we come back.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Continental Airlines. With over 260 destinations in more than 50 countries, Continental makes it easy to create your own worldwide tour. Continental Airlines. Work hard. Fly right.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, coming to you from the legendary Savoy Hotel here in London. And, of course, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-Peter. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here in the air. And even if you're not staying at this hotel, take a deep breath, walk in. Don't just look forward. Look up. Look at the ceilings. Look at the walls. Look at the artwork that they've managed to preserve that goes back over, oh, God, 100, almost 200 years. So it's amazing. And then get a history lesson about who stayed here, what rooms they were in. You know, I said Monet stayed here. When I go to Venice, I always stay in room 306 of the Europa Regina Hotel because that was the room where Monet painted one of his most famous paintings of the canal. We actually tracked down that painting, and we didn't have to do very much looking because we just had to look out our window, and we knew exactly what to look for. When you can live the history, that makes it all so much more important. Anyway, let's go to the emails. We've got one from Sally in Allendale, Michigan. This may be a silly question. I love letters that start out with that. I'll be the judge of that, Sally. But I'm putting it out there anyway. I love to travel. I am an empty nester, and I was recently laid off from my position of nearly 20 years. Ooh. What I would love to do is travel more, but cannot afford to do that. I would love to be a secret traveler. I could be that person who checks out resorts and hotels, destinations for the quality of services and amenities and reports back to the resort administrators, owners. Is there such a job out there? Yes, Sally, there is a job out there, and it's top secret. No. Here's the thing. What you're really talking about is being a mystery shopper. And there are some companies that will do that for you, but the work is few and far between in terms of consistency. There are other jobs out there, meaning for AAA, you can be an inspector and go check out hotels. They used to do that for the Mobile Guide. Now that's been taken over by Forbes. I'm sure they have similar inspecting jobs. The pay isn't great, but guess what? You get to do what you want to do, Sally, and that is you get to travel, and those expenses are covered. So I would check out with AAA. They're actually based in Florida, the national organization. I'd also check out with the Forbes folks who took over the brand of the Mobile 5-Star. So it's the 5-Diamond, which is AAA, and the Mobile 5-Star. And then check it out and see what happens. And have fun out there. When the going gets tough, the tough travel anyway, Sally. Let's see if you can get paid for it. Here's one from Gerard in Lindenhurst, New York. I know Lindenhurst. Peter, we have traveled around the U.S. extensively, myself, my wife, my three kids, aged 16, 14, and 11, and have always done very well fare-wise, but we are going on a cruise out of Stockholm in July of next year for a week, and the airfares are high, around $1,000 nonstop. What is my best strategy for getting the lowest airfare for a New York to Stockholm nonstop a couple of days before and leaving? Okay, blah, blah, blah. Okay, here's what you got to do, Gerard. Don't think point to point. That's a big mistake. Think one stop and pack light. And what I mean by that is you're going to find whatever discounts you're going to find them more from New York to London than you're going to ever find them from New York to Stockholm. So what you do is you buy one round-trip ticket from New York to London as cheaply as you can, and then go on the websites for either Ryanair or EasyJet, and they go out of secondary and tertiary airports out of England like Luton or Stansted, and to secondary or tertiary airports sometimes out of Sweden, and buy two round-trips or an additional round-trip from that. But the one caution I have to give you, and it's a biggie, pack light. Because EasyJet and Ryanair love to hose you with a capital H when it comes to your bags. I mean, if you're wearing a pair of Birkenstocks and you got a backpack and you're a fugitive from justice, that's the airline for you. But if you have any bags whatsoever, your issue is going to be, of course, that's where they're going to nail you for baggage. We had an issue that happened to me on EasyJet where I was flying from London, actually Luton, to Paris on a 29-pound ticket, and they charged me $512 for a bag, because they said I was overweight, and their fine print was so fine you couldn't find it until you got to page 5 of their website. That was a $500 misunderstanding, because I went on the air the next day and showed the receipt and told everybody never to fly them again unless you had a pair of Birkenstocks, a backpack, and you were a fugitive from justice. So, bottom line is, if you can pack light, and your kids can pack light, that's how you're going to save money on the airfare. And no matter what I say, trying to buy an airfare to Stockholm in October or November for next July is suicidal, because the airline's computer systems aren't set up in any way, shape, or form to offer you any kind of discount outside of 60 days. So wait just a little bit, okay? Wait for February or March when you can actually maybe get some deals. But even then, try to get the deal to go to London on a round trip and then buy a secondary round trip from London to Stockholm. You'll save a lot more money as long as you follow my advice around the bags. If you don't follow my advice about the bags, you get no sympathy from me. I will personally come to your house and slap you. Actually, I won't have to do that. You'll be slapping yourself, because when you get that bill for the bag, you will not be a happy guy. All right? Any other questions you've got? Of course, email me to peter@petergreenberg.com. And you can always call us at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. Coming back with a museum that you've probably not heard about, but you need to see. Back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is brought to you by
Travel Guard. Visit travelguard.com/unlucky. Tell us what makes you the world's unluckiest traveler, and you could win a $10,000 dream vacation. Brought to you by Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
52 minutes after the hour, coming to you from the legendary historic Savoy Hotel here in London, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know what to do. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. I've been saying all along that the Savoy itself is a living, breathing museum if you want to look at some history. But there are so many museums in London, many of which you've heard about. You've heard of the Tate. You've heard of the British Museum. You've heard of the V&A. But not many of you have heard of this museum. It's about 5 miles from here, and it's called the Hornung Museum. And joining me now is the museum's marketing development manager, Andrew Wilshire. Hey, Andrew.
Hi there, Peter.
So, I mean, I have to tell you, this is news to me, too. Tell me about the Hornung, because I did not know about it.
Well, interestingly, the Hornung's history dates back, actually, to when the Savoy opened, in that a Victorian tea trader, Frederick Hornung, who was a great philanthropist and was also a member of parliament, he started As he was running his tea business that his father had set up, he started getting people to collect things for him from all over the globe.
Was there any madness to it? I mean, was there any reason to it? He just bring something back?
Well, you know, he was very much really inspired by anything that he liked.
So it's a very eclectic collection.
It is quite an eclectic collection. I mean, it was anything which was aesthetic, which he had an interest in, he would get people to acquire. And, you know, the story goes that he would say to his tea traders, when you go away trading, bring me back something interesting.
And all right, so of course you beg the most obvious question, how wild is this collection?
Well, it's pretty diverse, I think it's fair to say. You know, we've got everything from African masks to Egyptian mummies. We've got some absolutely fantastic historical musical instruments.
Well, that's a sum. You have like 8,000.
Yeah, we've got a pretty big collection, actually. And we've got quite a lot on display of our material. We've got, for example, we've got a music room which has got 1,600 of our instruments on display. So
1,600?
1,600. So it's a pretty phenomenal range of things.
Let me ask a stupid question. Have you ever tried to play them? Has anybody actually played them?
Well, we do have specialists who very occasionally can come in and try them. But to be honest, we're all about trying to preserve things for future generations. So we have to be really careful with that.
Of course.
So, but what we do is we do a lot of events and performances. And what we will do is invite performers to come in and play historic instruments, which is
similar. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Now, if you have Mr. Horniman saying to all the traders, bring me back something, was there anything they ever brought back where he said, oh, no, I'm not taking that?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure, to be honest. I mean, I think the sheer breadth of the collection tells us
he took everything. He took everything.
I think he took everything. In fact, there's a great story, actually, which Horniman's wife in the kind of 1890s, she reached a point and she said, look, either we go or this collection goes. Because he started opening his house up to the public. And so what happened is he actually commissioned a purpose-built museum. He got a great architect.
See, I thought you were going to tell me he had her stuff mounted and she's on display too. No?
No, he took the easy option. He moved up to the gardens to another house. We've got gardens there. And he moved out and had a purpose-built museum erected.
And how did the relationship work out?
I think it was pretty good after that, to be honest.
So but, she put her foot down and...
She put her foot down.
And now the foot's on display.
He made the right move. He made the right move. I think he was sensible. They moved out. So,
for those people visiting the museum for the first or for many times, what would you say is the most surprising item on display?
Well, probably the most surprising item we've got is actually a torture chair that Frederick Horniman purchased, and believing it dated from the Spanish Inquisition in the 1600s. It's got a date stamp on there, which supposedly showed its authenticity. Now, what happened is Horniman paid quite a considerable sum of money for
this. I've always wanted a signed torture chair. Not just one of your regular I want an autographed edition torture chair. Yeah.
But, the curious thing with this is that in probably about 30 years ago, people started doing some testing on this and some dating, and they found that the actual chair itself is a fake and only dates from 1850, but the instruments of torture actually date from the 1600s. So it's a real sort of curiosity of the Victorian
age. I only want to deal with genuine instruments of torture. Well, none of these replicas.
Some bits are definitely genuine, but the chair itself, well, probably only about 150 or so years old.
You said they were testing it. What did they do? Put people like, just sit right there. Nothing's going to, ow!
Yeah, they probably were sort of pushing a hand on it just to see how sharp it was, that kind of stuff.
So
we've got a whole range of interesting types of material that people can come and check out, actually. So,
now, do you have a rotating exhibit, too?
We do. We have a whole series of temporary exhibitions. So, for example, one of the exciting things we've got coming up, which is in March next year, is we have got the V&A Museum, which no doubt a lot of your listeners will have heard of. We are taking some of their musical instrument collection, which they currently haven't got on display, and we're showing some of that at the Horniman as a parallel to our musical instruments. So, you know, but if you come before then, you can see a scientific art installation by a Los Angeles-based artist, or you can see paintings from Central India, which are quite stunning.
And what I love about it is it's not necessarily in every brochure. It's a great discovery. It's the Horniman Museum about 5 miles from the Savoy. So you can't walk it, but it's a cab ride away. Andrew Wilshire, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate that. That music means we're out of time for this hour. For those stations leaving us, have a great rest of your weekend. More information on our website, of course, at petergreenberg.com. And for those stations sticking around, we got a whole lot more coming from the Savoy Hotel in London. Back right after this.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com. Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome aboard Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Hope you're having a wonderful weekend wherever you happen to be. Get out your maps, boys and girls, because we've been living on planes, but now we've landed at 51 degrees, 30 minutes north, 0 degrees, 7 minutes west. We're coming to you from the Savoy Hotel in London, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem so we can solve it right here on the air. Such history here at this hotel. I've been coming since I've been 24 years old. They've just gone through almost $300 million renovation, mostly a restoration, to bring it back to its original grand scale, and it really is. And they actually made it brighter with natural light. Amazing history here. They've never really touched the American Bar, which is great. If you really want to see the way it used to be, it's right there. The Thames Foyer restaurant, of course, and of course the River restaurant right overlooking the Thames. Unbelievable. And a great place to stay. And even if you're not staying here, you just walk in, look around, and don't forget to look up. Everybody you can imagine who's ever been anybody has stayed here. A couple things in the news I want to talk about. What a surprise. Southwest Airlines reporting higher demand for September. Their traffic actually rose more than 5% in September from a year earlier. That is significant, and was up almost 5% for the third quarter itself. This is an airline that's making money left and right for not charging you things. There are some lessons to be learned by other airlines there. And yet, the other airlines continue to rack up what they call ancillary revenue. We're talking not $1 billion, not $2 billion, but by the end of this year, close to $13 billion will be racked up by airlines worldwide for what they call ancillary revenue or a la carte pricing, for charging you for everything from blankets and pillows to checking your bags. You know, if you do the math, those Southwest Airlines ads really tell the story, and that's why the market shifted in their favor. Per person, you're talking $120 additional. That's $60 each way to check two bags on most airlines. $25 for the first bag, $35 for the second. I just did the math wrong. It's $140, and it's that bad. Now you add that to a family of four, you're nearly at $500, over and above what you thought you were paying for your ticket. So interesting news about that. One thing I do want to talk about, which is near and dear to me because of an organization that I'm a member of, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm on the board of directors of a group called Airline Ambassadors. That's, if you want to get their website, it's airlineamb.org. We run between 10 and 12 missions a month to orphanages around the world, and one of the things we're much, much involved with, and we're getting the airlines involved too, which is a big deal because without the airlines, this problem wouldn't exist. It couldn't exist. And that's sex trafficking, children at risk. It is a growing crime of staggering proportions. And if you go to the Airline Ambassadors website, you will see how you can get involved, not just in terms of donating money. Everybody can do that. I'm talking about being alert as a passenger. I mean, this all started when one of the airline passengers on a U.S. Airways flight from Washington to Palm Beach, Florida, noticed something strange about the man and the boy who ran up late to catch a flight. When they asked the guy for the boy's name, he didn't know it when he got up to the gate. And that was the first indication that something was wrong here and about why this boy was going to Florida. And the little boy said, I thought I was going to North Carolina. Now we understand what was going on. It was child trafficking. It was sexual exploitation. It's bad news. And just something I want you to know about. And if you want more information about that and how you can be more aware as a passenger, because it's got to be stopped, go to our website, petergreenberg.com. You'll find a number of projects listed there, including the nonprofit Polaris Project. And we'll talk to you about the numbers here are really staggering. As many as 300,000 children are trafficked annually, and most are used for prostitution and pornography. This is serious business, guys. It is a serious business, but it's serious business for us to stop. It's a $32 billion business, and it's a crime. So I just thought I'd mention that because we need to be more aware of it. Stop, look, and listen when you get on a plane. You might be saving somebody's entire life. Like what happened with this one passenger who called attention to the situation to the airline officials, and they got the guy. And when they got him, you know what they found out? He's been doing this a lot. Bottom line here, you can help. Every time you get on a plane, you know, and think about this. We live in a world of unaccompanied minors on planes anyway. That's one thing. But when you see a man and a boy or a man and a girl, it could be a father and a daughter. It could be a father and a son. But if the guy doesn't even know the boy's name, that's like a huge alarm. And if they don't even know where they're going, a bigger alarm. So three cheers to that passenger. I'll even identify her. Her name is Deborah Sigmund. Good for you that she did that, because we need more people like Deborah. In any case, lots of stuff to talk about in the news. Guess what, boys and girls? Word has it that in the next 18 months or even sooner, airlines and security officers might actually come to their senses, and they might actually allow liquids and gels back onto the planes. All the women in this room listening to me right now just raised their hands and started cheering because, of course, they have dreams of moisturizer. They have, see, they're now smiling about it. But let's be real. I mean, for those people who watch the series MacGyver, I could probably make a bomb out of a quarter and a piece of peanut butter. So, let's be real. Stopping me from bringing my moisturizer on the plane, or a bottle of wine that's unopened, or a can of Diet Coke, is getting a little silly. Because on the very same plane they don't want me to bring my moisturizer or my Diet Coke or my bottle of wine, what are they serving me for dinner? A knife and a fork. And they're serving it to me with a glass. All I have to do is break off the glass and slash somebody's neck and I'm in the cockpit. So I'm not trying to give anybody the wrong idea here. I'm just trying to say, can we be a little bit more sensible about our security? We're not really saving the day here. What we're doing is, well, some people might suggest it's a large international conspiracy by pharmacists and Boots and Duane Reade and CVS. At the very least, don't confiscate it. Sell it on the other end. Meaning when you land, if I have to give up my bottle of wine in Cleveland to go to L.A., when I land in L.A., there should be a reciprocal bottle of wine waiting for me. We should just pay it forward. That's how we do security now. We just pay it forward. If you leave a bottle, you get a bottle. Right? Now, I know many of my women friends go, but that's not my brand of moisturizer. Just shut up. The concept is it shouldn't be taken away from you because it's not saved anybody. That's the point. And now, I know that security people will say we have not been attacked since 2001, but the absence of a terrorist act does not presume the presence of intelligent safety. Think about that. It's like telling me that all the airlines are safe because we haven't had a crash. The absence of a crash does not mean does not presume the presence of safety. I'm all in favor of common sense and intelligence. How about that? And when we come back, we're going to talk about common sense and some really great intelligence when it comes to travel. You know why? Because it's about cultural travel, inserting yourself into the culture, immersing yourself into the culture, and doing it smart. We'll tell you how to do it when we come back from the Savoy in London right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Continental Airlines. With over 260 destinations in more than 50 countries, Continental makes it easy to create your own worldwide tour. Continental Airlines. Work hard. Fly right.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, coming to you from the Savoy Hotel in London. Peter Greenberg here with you, taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem so we can solve it right here on the air. And as we do every week at this time, I encourage you to go to our website with the imaginative name, petergreenberg.com, to get a comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that essential and hard work in Haiti, in Western China, in Chile, and, of course, in the Gulf. It may not be on the front pages where you are, but it's on our front page, and I encourage you in the most emphatic way to look for this list, because it'll tell you how you can get involved over and above just donating money, but how to physically, actively, on location, get involved in an intelligent way and really help out. And it's the best vacation you can give yourself, because it's what you're giving to other people. Speaking about a vacation you can give yourself, you know, there are guidebooks and there are guidebooks, and so many of them are just destination driven. And I'm an experienced kind of guy. But you can't be an experienced kind of guy unless you understand the experience you're about to have and how to do it in a reasonable, sensitive way, meaning the culture. How do you be a smart traveler, but a smart cultural traveler? And my next guest is the executive editor and the series editor for the Culture Smart Travel Guides. His name, Jeffrey Chesler. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hi. Hi, Peter.
So, I mean, you just scared me before we did the show. You told me you've done 80 of these.
Well, yes. In 7 years, we've gone from zero to 80.
And you've literally covered the globe, because it's not just the Culture Smart series in Paris or France. It's not just the Culture Smart series in some of the more popular countries for the West. You've got one for Iran, too.
Well, we've got one for Iran. We've got one for Azerbaijan coming up. We've done off the beaten path destinations. Because basically the world has shrunk. Nowhere's too far. We rarely do live in a global village. And people are traveling as never before, both for pleasure and for business. And today you're likely to come into contact with people which would have been unimaginable in a way that would have been unimaginable to our parents or grandparents even.
But, you know, most guidebooks will tell you where to eat. I think it's a safe assumption based on what I've seen in your books. You're also telling me how to eat, meaning, you know, what the customs are in those particular countries, what's considered acceptable behavior, what's considered polite, what's considered downright rude, how you can immerse yourself in the culture and get the best possible experience.
Well, what these guides set out to do basically is to give you a compass to general principles. You can't immerse yourself in the culture just in 168 pages in a little pocketbook. But they are door openers, and they do give you a general idea of not just the do's and don'ts and taboos, but the cultural context that they arise out of. So give me
an example.
Well, there are certain societies where face is very important, where consensus is and harmony and lack of confrontation. Japan is a classic example.
Sure. Well, the sense of face, for example, in China. I mean, I was there with a group of friends of mine, and I thought I was being very cool. We landed in a port city that had not had visitors, and they were very excited to see us. And they wanted to show us their commune where they actually manufacture things on light machinery. And we were going to go take a tour and see it. It was just a group of like 12 of my friends. But we were the delegation. We were the first guys there. And as we were walking with the mayor and the two red army guards and one translator, I noticed there was a basketball hoop. And I said to the mayor, oh, do you guys play basketball? And the translation came back, oh, yes, we like it. It's a very popular game. And I said, wow. And the basketball hoop that I was looking at was an old wooden backboard, and it was like kind of hanging off the wall. And I said, I got an idea, because I didn't want to spend the whole day touring light machinery factories. I said, how about we get a game going? Why don't we play your guys? And the Red Army guards, no, we cannot do that. It is not in the program. And the mayor didn't know what we were talking about. I said, no, you have to at least ask him if he'd like to play. And the Red Army guard said, I think I'm going to win this one. And the Red Army guard said, we are not going to ask him. I said, well, if you don't ask him, I'm going to lose face with my group. That they understood. And they quite reluctantly asked him. And he looked at me and he stared at me like, you're serious? I said, yeah, let's play. So he said, moment. He makes a phone call. That basketball hoop that we saw was for like, hadn't been used in 30 years. All of a sudden, I look, and there are 1,500 people coming over the hill carrying portable chairs, referees in white and black uniforms. They're bringing a large plexiglass roll-on board basketball. These guys were all 6'9". And I looked at my guys. I said, okay, now listen very carefully. We are going to lose badly, very, very badly. But we had such a great time. We gave them our shirts. They gave them their shirts at the end. Gave us their shirts at the end. Everybody posted pictures. The best thing happened. A week later, the first cruise ship showed up with all these blue-haired ladies in this port city, and the basketball team was there waiting for their next game.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, that just shows that games are a direct way in, right way into a culture.
And I was looking at your book on Iran, and I went right to the page where it told me what the favorite sports were in Tehran that I'd never even heard of and how to watch those sports.
Well, you'll get that kind of information from these books. There's a lot of factual information, but the real thrust of the books is how to strike up a rapport with total strangers.
How to have that conversation, that essential conversation.
Basic conversation. Then you discover all sorts of things. And basically, the first thing you have to do after some basic background reading...
Or you could say preliminary.
Oh, I can't at the moment. I'll do it tomorrow. Basically, what you have to do, really, is ask questions. People will always be glad to answer, and they're very flattered if you take an interest.
Just don't ask for directions.
That's another matter, of course.
Yes, because they'll answer that, too, and send you in the wrong way.
Possibly. Yeah.
But it is. Americans particularly are afraid to initiate a conversation in a foreign country because they just think they're going to, you know, the whole concept of the French being rude. I have to tell you something. I've been going to France since I'm 12 years old. I've never encountered a bad situation there.
Well, you're very lucky, because plenty have.
Write your letters to Jeffrey, please.
Right, no. Generally speaking, the way you initiate the conversation is very important. And it's not what you say almost, it's a matter of attitude. And if people feel that you are either condescending...
Always be deferential.
Right. And basically also know something about... body language, do you make eye contact, do or don't you shake hands? You obviously don't shake hands with women in very conservative Catholic or Muslim countries. So a lot of this stuff is common sense, but it's also applied to the context. And there are buttons you can push in every place, unwittingly.
Give me an example.
Well, an obvious example is where there are unresolved conflicts. If you are in Poland and you praise Lithuanian sausages, no, it's the other way around, in fact. They don't like it.
You better get that right, Jeffrey.
Well, any praise for a hostile neighbor or historic enemy will go down badly.
For example, if you're in Australia, they love making fun of the Kiwis. They love making fun of New Zealanders. If you're in France, everybody dumps on the Belgians. Everybody has their own version of what we would originally call the Polish joke.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
I know.
So,
if you're in Hawaii, they dump on the Portuguese. People forget the they do.
No.
What?
Nothing.
You can say it.
No, I didn't say anything. I know nothing about Hawaii and the Portuguese. I must confess.
Well, then here's my advice to you, Jeffrey. When you go to Hawaii and you meet a Portuguese, don't make a Portuguese joke.
Okay.
It won't go.
I would understand that in Africa better, of course.
Yes, of course.
Where they've had a presence.
But it's also the gestures. You mentioned body language. Mm-hmm. You know, when we say something's A-okay by putting our index finger on the thumb and holding the three fingers up, that works well in America, but in Brazil it means it's a curse.
It's an obscenity.
Yes.
And in France it means something of little worth. So... you can get things seriously wrong. And I think that, you can't be too careful, basically. If the world is now, he said portentously, so much smaller that the opportunities for making gaffes are so much bigger. And I think that if you're in business in particular, this is something you have to brush up on before you fly in for a meeting. Negotiating styles and tactics can differ considerably in different countries.
And whether you're a business traveler or a leisure traveler, once you become culturally smarter, not just smart, but smarter, you are almost guaranteed to have a better experience.
Yeah. A classic example is the Egyptians. In Arab countries, generally, a lot of time is spent in building up trust and relationships. Time isn't money. And if you go to Egypt and you don't do the small talk and you don't have the tea... and you don't engage in pleasantries, and you try to cut to the chase, there is no chase. You've lost the race.
Exactly.
You've lost the race.
And although I've been known to say somebody, no inshallah, 8 o'clock means 8 o'clock.
You know about IBM. IBM, inshallah, bukra ma'alesh. God willing, tomorrow, never mind.
And on that note, the names of the books, of course, Culture Smart Guides to the World, and the editor, Jeffrey Chesler. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In a preliminary way.
Oh, preliminary thank you, too.
We'll be right back.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit... The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
33 minutes after the hour, coming to you from the Savoy Hotel in London, Peter Greenberg here with you. When I had lunch in the Thames Foyer restaurant, you cannot walk out of there without passing a very dangerous place. Pastry and chocolate. And, of course, I had to have my next guest on because I need to know about these things. Even though I lost 68 pounds, I can at least look. Lionel Bataz, who's the executive pastry chef here at the Savoy. But your pedigree, sir, goes to restaurants that I know very, very well with, of course, Alain Ducasse and the Louis XV in Monaco.
Absolutely.
I've eaten there many, many times and lived to tell the tale. The most amazing design of a restaurant I've seen in my life, because there's maybe one table every 6 miles. The separation between diners is amazing. And at the right of everybody's chair is a little bench for the ladies to put their pocketbook. And it's very quiet. And there's absolutely no way you could ever overhear a conversation at the other table because you can't see the other table.
Yeah, but I got to say that in Monaco, it's not really a question of rentability. So they don't have a lot of space, but in hotel they got because they can afford it. So.
They did. Although one night I went downstairs with Alain in the kitchen and we ate down there. That was cool.
Absolutely.
That was really cool. Yeah. Although I remember the very first time I had dinner there, he said, "Don't look at the menu. I'll make something for you." And I said, "Okay." And it was just great. And then I got the bill.
It was great as well.
The paramedics had to come get me. But it was memorable on two levels. The food was great, and the bill was great.
This is something that will never happen in the Savoy because we want to stay down to earth, and I think three-star restaurant is something very particular.
But, I mean, you first started working with Roger Verger, and then you went to Lalande, and now you come back to the Savoy. What's different about this place?
But I don't know if there is really something different. What is different is that 27 years ago when I used to start, gastronomy was mainly French. But in between, I mean, we had apprentices and we had commis that came to France to learn, and they returned to their homeland. And
it was always French style.
Yes, it was always French technique.
Yes.
Which is a technique. There's a big difference between a style, a technique, and an appellation. So it was a technique, and they brought the technique to their own land and adapted that to the seasonal product of their own ground. And I think that no gastronomy is something that is totally worldwide. It is totally wrong to say that France is still the land of gastronomy. I mean, UK is an island. By definition, you got here nice products. In UK, mothers and women are cooking at home. Don't forget that the crumble, every French love the crumble, and the crumble come from here. So, I mean, we all live on the same round planet, and
sure.
I hate this sort of gastronomic racism.
But when I walked out of the restaurant, what's the first thing I saw? Chocolate.
Yeah.
A lot of chocolate.
Absolutely.
You're making your own.
I'm making my own. We got an incredible partnership with Valrhona. So Valrhona select the cacao bean for us all around the planet, and they source it and they buy the ground and they pay the people well from Africa to Venezuela, which is quite important. It's a fair trade. It's very well done. And they give us the best.
Let's talk about fair trade, because I think people need to know that. When you're sourcing your items, you're making sure that the money that you're paying is actually going back to the people who are doing the work.
We try as most as possible. We try, yes, absolutely.
So what would you say is your most over-the-top chocolate thing that you make here?
Excuse me?
The most incredibly extravagant chocolate thing that you make.
Well, I think that we have created something beautiful, which is the first 3D chocolate tablet. That represents a legend of the Savoy, which is Caspar the Cat, and he's here. And generally, the chocolate tablets are engraved. And I wanted to recreate the Art Deco style. And Art Deco style is feminine, and it's volume and form. It's sensual, like chocolate. And Caspar is black. And we have made it with green pistachio.
Ooh,
on the side.
Like that.
And if you look at it very closely, it is Savoy. And at the same time, it fits with the packaging. So this is a close collaboration with Valrhona that sponsors us. Valrhona has got a design bureau, a very little design bureau that only designed for Pierre Hermé and this kind of pâtissier master. And they have designed us this tablet with our help and our.
And what's really cool about the Savoys? I mean, you make your own beds, you make your own tea. I see here you've got the chocolate going here, the bathrobes. I mean, you're not a hotel; you're a retail operation.
Absolutely, but this comes mainly from the support of our owner,
sure.
Fairmont, first of all, and then our general manager and management team. They sincerely believe in our skill, in what we can do, and every idea that we got, they look at it, and they support us. So I think that's why it's taking this way.
Well, happy to have you in London because I know where to find my chocolate now.
Thank you.
Oh, I know where to find a lot of chocolate now. I love it. And you do chocolate custom. If I said I want chocolate with almonds, but pistachio is even better, right?
We never say no at the Savoy.
Okay, I'm coming back to see you later. Leon Avatares, thank you so much, sir. We really appreciate that. And when we come back, more of your emails and a special guest. Back right after this from the Savoy in London with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide.
Now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Continental Airlines. With over 260 destinations in more than 50 countries, Continental makes it easy to create your own worldwide tour. Continental Airlines. Work hard. Fly right.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from the Savoy Hotel in London, where we've just been inundated by chocolate. I don't know what we're going to do except continue on with the show until we're done with the show, and then you know exactly what we're going to be doing. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com, as did Linda did from Beaumont, Texas. She says, we've been trying to plan a November 20th to 27th vacation for 18 family members. Wow, that's not a vacation. That's a full-time job. Four generations aged 1 to 86. Wow, and we are having a hard time deciding which way to go. Well, doesn't that define your entire family, Linda, or my family? Nobody can make a decision. You have to take charge. No ideas we have are ideal. We would greatly appreciate your expertise and advice. In case you want more information, some want beautiful scenery, duh, a lake or riverfront home. Some want Disney World. Oh, please, don't do that. Others don't. Some want to be all in one big house. Others don't care. Okay, I've got the answer. Are you ready? Don't laugh at me. Take a Disney cruise. And match it with 4 days at Disney World. So you basically bookend the whole thing. And for those people who think a Disney cruise is going to be 7 days of, it's a small world after all, it's not. I went on a Disney cruise. I was convinced I was going to be a barricaded suspect with Mickey, and I wasn't. They've really gotten their act together. And if you want to go on the water, there's your cruise. You come back and do 3 or 4 days at Disney World, and then everybody's happy if that's what they want. Or, you know, I would just investigate. First of all, the one thing you didn't tell me, Linda, is how far you want to travel. You didn't tell me that. Somebody tells you with 18 family members and you got 1 to 86, you don't want to go overseas. You want to stay pretty close to home. And if that's the case, why don't you think about renting a beautiful villa or apartment building where you can actually get the whole family there and cook for your own selves, save a lot of money, and then go out when you want to go out, and everybody gets what they get to do what they want to do. If you go to our website, petergreenberg.com, we have a comprehensive list of a lot of companies that specialize in villa and estate rentals, which in November might be a pretty good bargain. One way to do it, I would do it that way. Hey, joining me right now, a little special guest. As a matter of fact, she writes for the Mail on Sunday in the Sunday Times, Sarah Turner. Hey, Sarah.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Now, you know I'm coming from the Savoy, which is a legacy hotel. Just recently reopened on October 10th, otherwise known as 10-10-10. What's your take on it?
Well, London House has always had a number of luxury hotels, but they've tended to hark back to a kind of a past era of luxury, a kind of aristocratic. The Savoy was always kind of daringly modern. You know, it had lifts. It had ensuite bathrooms. When it opened in the early 20th century, it kind of defined luxury. And now it's kind of quite exciting to see it, see how it's going to take on the 21st century.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, one of the things that, that people worry about, of course, is the strength or the weakness, as it were, of the British pound. It's still not the best deal for the dollar. But one of the things I really like, and I notice that you do too, is, and people say, oh, I want to go to Greece. I go, no, go to Turkey, because you can beat the high cost of the euro there.
Yes, but...
Was that a yes? Was that a yes?
I mean, but London, there are plenty of ways where you can save money. You know, you go outside on the Strand and you can get a bus to pretty much anywhere you want to go.
Oh, sure you can. I'm not comparing Turkey to London. I'm comparing Turkey to Greece in terms of the euro.
I don't know. There was a survey recently, which actually said when you get to Turkey, things are pretty expensive. Buying, everyday objects like a can of Pringles. They compared how much Pringles cost.
Okay, let me ask you a question. When was the last time you wanted to go to Turkey to buy Pringles?
Yes. I mean...
Come on.
I don't know. If you have children, sometimes they...
Well, you have to teach your children not to eat Pringles.
Sometimes parents weaken. They need
okay.
to know these things.
Okay. I was just throwing it out there. All right. Well, anyway, bottom line is... I totally agree with you on the Savoy. It's modern without being in your face because there's so much history here. So it's a wonderful combination of high tech with history. And why wouldn't I want that? Because you don't change your lifestyle when you change your location, but you still want to appreciate the experience that you have. Hey, Sarah Turner, you can read her in the Financial Times, the Mail on Sunday, and the Sunday Times. Thanks for that surprise little guest appearance. When we come back, another surprise guest appearance from somebody I haven't talked to in years, my good buddy Chris Reynolds from the Los Angeles Times with the best of the best. Back with more from the Savoy Hotel in London right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
52 minutes after the hour, coming from the Savoy Hotel, the recently reopened Savoy Hotel in London. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER, and if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. Just not too long ago was Sunday, October 10th, otherwise known as 10-10-10, and a lot of people wanted to get married on that day for reasons I have no idea. A lot of people thought they were going to get some great travel deals that day, but our next guest thought it would be a great idea to go for a list of 10 on a lot of different levels. His name, the travel writer from the Los Angeles Times, and my old buddy who I haven't talked to in a long time, but I'm happy to have him on the show, Chris Reynolds. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. So Americans love lists, and you've got a number of 10 bests. So
any excuse for a 10 best list, we figure, is reason enough. So, yes, we went hog wild with the 10 best.
All right. Well, since we're in London, why don't you give me your 10 best destinations for Europe this year?
Okay. And I have to say that, you know, this was a group effort, and my colleague Susan Spano, who's lived in both Paris and Rome, was the main contributor to this part of it. And, well, I'll start the list with a location in England, Avebury. Have you been there?
I have not.
It's about 80 miles west of London, but the more relevant detail might be that it's about 20 miles north of Stonehenge, and it's a lot like Stonehenge. It's got those Neolithic stone monuments, but instead of the, you know, that scene at Stonehenge that you know so well from pictures, it's a bigger circle, and there's a village kind of mixed in among the great big stones that came along after the stones were placed. And you run across crop circles out there, too, and it's just a very interesting place.
Okay, that's number one of ten. Number two.
Yeah, Brussels, which is always underrated. Great beer, great food, especially seafood, great design. New Brené Museum.
I got to tell you one more thing. There are two things about Brussels food that people don't understand how cool it is. They have the best French fries. I don't care what the French say. The Belgians have the best French fries, and they're the best chocolatiers that I've ever seen, even better than the Swiss.
I got to go along with you on that. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, so you got Brussels in there. Keep going.
Okay. In Rome, there's a neighborhood called EUR, and I'd never heard of this. Susan unearthed this. It's about 5 miles southwest of the center of Rome, and it was built for a World's Fair that never happened. The Exposizione Universale Roma, forgive me, Italians, for that. It was supposed to happen in 1942, but...
Gee, I wonder what got in the way.
Mussolini was in office, and all these interesting buildings got built, and they then never got celebrated the way they were supposed to. They're still there.
I love it. But the next one you have on the list has the most unusual name considering where it is. It's in Denmark, but what's it called?
It's the Louisiana Museum of Modern Art. And not only that, but the name of the Danish island that it's on is Zealand. So you'd be forgiven for getting a little confused about that. But it's contemporary art since 1945, and by all accounts a pretty fascinating place.
It sounds like my GPS would have a meltdown on that one.
Yeah.
All right. Next on the list. Next one.
North of Sicily. It's a volcano and an active volcano. People think that the Big Island of Hawaii is the only active volcano we have right now, but that's not true. Island of Salina, go up onto the rooftop of the Hotel Signum on a clear night, you can see the volcano going off.
And I've actually cruised around Sicily, and at night you see Mount Etna going up. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay, now you got one in France. Let's hear it for the French.
Yes, and did you ever take any French in school? Because if you did, I'm going to let you be the first one to say this.
Vézelay.
Great. I'll go along with you on that.
Okay, good.
Some people say that the Abbey Church here, which is in the Burgundy region, ranks up there with Chartres Cathedral. It goes back to about the 12th century, and its whole history is intermingled with the history and of followers of Mary Magdalene. It's about 235 miles from Brussels, if you want to keep the underappreciated Europe theme going. But anyway, so that's a fascinating church that isn't as much on the people's radar as it could be.
And neither is the next one. And neither is the next one in Germany. You got two in Germany, actually.
Yes, the Vitra Design Museum, which is it's actually close to Basel, Switzerland. And it's Vitra is one company that you may have heard of, but this museum takes in more than just one company's work, and you can look at American Shaker furniture or French Art Nouveau. You can look at some interesting buildings they have on the property, including a geodesic dome designed by Buckminster Fuller, which I think is kind of a kick.
Oh, that's fun. And then, of course, Dresden, which, of course, was destroyed in World War II, but it's back.
Yep. They spent years rebuilding it, and, you know, it's well-positioned. It's if you take the train between Prague and Berlin, then Dresden's right there on the route. So it's a place worth thinking about. It's about 120 miles south of Berlin. Number nine is the Tarn River Gorge in the south of France, which kind of wriggles through that part of the country through a limestone plateau, and it's near the Cevennes Mountains, which is a national park in France, and there are lots of great old medieval hill towns there.
And last but not least, you have the Rioja Alavesa in Spain.
Yeah, which is wine country, and it's about an hour south of Bilbao. And now that I've said Bilbao, you might be thinking of Frank Gehry, the architect, since he did the Guggenheim Museum there. And the wineries in Rioja Alavesa have, many of them, been designed by big-name architects. There's one there that was designed by Frank Gehry. There's another that was designed by Zaha Hadid.
All right. Chris Reynolds, our good pal from the Los Angeles Times. Of course, you can read more of Chris Reynolds. Go to their website, latimes.com. Thank you, Chris. We really appreciate that. We got all 10 in. Amazing. That music means we're out of time for the show. We got to thank Steve Harris doing the engineering work here in London. Wayne Taylor on the boards back in the East Coast of the United States. Dominic Blocker, our producer here. Shelley Goncharowski, our producer in Seattle. Brett Perkins and all the staff of the Savoy Hotel. We're going for chocolate. We'll see you guys next week from another location around the world.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com.